This week on Making Contact,
to learn that a bear can live in a cage for over 20 years, it's really horrific.
Women are gaining influence as leaders throughout the world, fighting for peace, justice, the environment, and civil society. In this program, we profile four animal rights activists. Alice Eng is the executive director of Animals Asia Foundation, dedicated to rescuing the moon bear. Rosamira Guillen is the executive director of Proyecto Titi, promoting the survival of the cotton-top tamarin monkey in Colombia. Lorena Aguilar works with the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, and Elena Bakova heads up the Saiga Conservation Alliance to protect the Saiga antelope in Uzbekistan. I'm Sandina Robbins, your host this week on Making Contact. This program is a special collaboration with the Women Rising radio series. Animal rights movements base their struggles on the intrinsic worth and value of all species. For Alice Eng, who sees herself as both Chinese and American, the appreciation of that intrinsic worth began at an early age.
My parents immigrated to the U.S. in the 1950s, right after the Cultural Revolution, and so they were escaping hunger. They raised us in a really traditional setting, and so my father would bring home live animals, actually, to slaughter for food, and I felt really uncomfortable with that, and I think that's where it started. I think I have a very strong sense of empathy with people and with animals. I see value in all of them. I see the value in every single animal and every single insect and their part in our environment. If we remove one of them, it shifts everything off balance. And so being a human, you can't help but think that, gosh, we have shifted so many things. What can we do to minimize that shift, to minimize our own impact? Like I said, we started from really humble beginnings. My parents wanted better for us. You know, they wanted us to have an education and to make a better lives for ourselves. So when I graduated, I went to work for a large company, and I did information technology and programming and made a lot of money and made my parents really happy. But after a couple of years, I just didn't feel comfortable with it. And I just could not see myself giving to a corporate cause any longer. I wanted to do something that was beyond that. And so I quit my job. Shortly thereafter, I started working for an organization called Wild Aid.
Wild Aid put Alice in charge of their shark conservation campaign, where she found herself in a conflict between her commitment to preserving nature and her traditional Chinese upbringing.
Sharks are the apex predator in the oceans, and so when their numbers diminish, it impacts the entire ecology of the ocean. About 100 million shark and shark-like fish, like includes skates and rays, are pulled out of the ocean every year. 100 million. When I first heard that statistic, I was shocked. I thought, gosh, is there even 100 million sharks in the oceans? But that's how much is being pulled out. And it's in a way that is completely wasteful. Some of them are pulled out and finned. Basically, their fins are cut off and their bodies are discarded back into the ocean. And so when you think about how slowly they reproduce and how quickly we're taking from the ocean, you can't ignore that there's going to be huge impacts on the ecology of the oceans. So my focus was working on the consumption side of shark fin soup. And with that, I developed a shark exhibition. For myself, my parents still have issues with giving up shark fin soup. I mean, they still like to have it because they had very little growing up. And it's a huge symbol of prosperity. I remember very distinctly, my sister had gotten married in 1994, and I refused to have the shark fin soup. And to save face, I had to leave the table and pretend to address the guests so that way my parents wouldn't be embarrassed that I wouldn't have the shark fin soup. It was one of these deciding moments in my life where I just needed to say to my parents, look, this is what I believe in. I believe so firmly in it, and I respect you, but please respect my decisions.
China beckoned again to Alice Eng when she learned about the work of Jill Robinson and the Animals Asia Foundation. Jill had managed to negotiate with the Chinese government to rescue hundreds of endangered moon bears. These Asiatic black bears were caged under excruciating conditions while their gallbladders were milked for the bear bile used in Chinese medicine.
When I first learned about the bear farming, I was appalled because I think there are a lot of horrendous things that happen out there. But to learn that a bear can live in a cage for over 20 years in the same position where it can't stretch and it can't move, it just seems tragic. So learning about this story and then learning about how Jill discovered it was exceptionally moving for me.
Jill Robinson describes how she discovered the captive Asiatic black bears in China in her own words.
There was this female moon bear with her paw stretched through the bars of the cage. And I did something in retrospect, which was very, very stupid. But her paw was there and it seemed the most natural thing in the world just to take it. And she didn't rip my arm from my shoulders, as she had every right to do. She just rhythmically squeezed my fingers. It was a moment I'll never, never forget.
I discovered Animals Asia when I was doing the shark conservation work in Asia. And I knew that Jill had been there for many years. And I was really impressed because she had signed the first agreement to work on animal welfare in China before any other organization. And to me, that was really impressive because I understood the culture there. And she was a woman. And that said to me that she was extremely diplomatic. She understood the culture and she wasn't judging. I think those are the issues that other nonprofits have because they like to tell people what to do instead of learning what they need and working around those needs. And when I had found out that there was a job opportunity there, I couldn't pass it over. I had to seek her out. And that's what led me to Animals Asia. The Asiatic black bear, it's known affectionately as the moon bear because it has a beautiful crescent-shaped moon on its chest. It's got big round Mickey Mouse ears and it's extremely inquisitive. And what the bear has is something in the gallbladder called ursodeoxycholic acid. And this is what's being farmed to be used in traditional medicine. The ursodeoxycholic acid, also known as UDCA, has regenerative properties. Actually, I should mention there's 54 alternatives to bear bile, both herbal and synthetic. Bear bile does work, make no mistake about it. I mean, it's been around for 3,000 years. But because there are all these alternatives to it, there's no reason that we should be farming the bears any longer. So Jill is just a phenomenal person. She very early on learned the concept of saving face. And for the Chinese culture, that's a really important thing to have. So she would find win-win situations where both the government would benefit and the animals would benefit. In this case, it was saving face for the government saying that they're doing conservation work, that they're actually being proactive about conserving this endangered species. And it was something that was monumental because it was something that came from the Chinese. It wasn't something that was pushed upon them. And so in 2000, they signed that agreement. And in that agreement, it said that we would save 500 bears and bring them to our sanctuary, and that the government and Animals Asia would work eventually towards the end of bear farming altogether. So we work very closely with the traditional Chinese medicine community. There's a lot of practitioners who believe in using alternatives to endangered species products. And so we have developed a labeling scheme for the practitioners who don't sell their endangered species products, bear bile in particular. It's a symbol that they can put right outside their shop. I think with the bear bile, being able to promote those alternatives from within the Chinese traditional medicine community is key. I think coming from those practitioners, people that the community trusts, will be the key to bringing this practice to an end.
Costa Rican Lorena Aguilar is an international advocate for the protection of nature as a cultural ecologist and gender specialist with the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, or IUCN. Like Alice Eng, Lorena learned early on that conservation cannot be imposed on people, their communities, or even on nations. Conservation must be a partnership.
My father used to own a coffee plantation, and he made me go and work every weekend picking coffee. And in vacations, he made me go and live with the people that were picking coffee. And I kind of understood from very early in my life that things were not the same for everybody. I come to realize that there were people that had no shoes, but had big dreams. People that might have just a piece of bread, but they will share it with you. When you start seeing people struggling for survival, and you look at the assets that they have around them, especially in developing countries, in rural areas, the only asset that people can grab to improve their living conditions is nature. Call it land, call it forest, call it water, call it coast, call it fishes. That's all that they have. And when I start working in the environmental sector, I am an anthropologist. And a lot of people were looking at the environment only as a green issue. Oh, pollution. Oh, destruction. But what happened with the people that were around those things? What was their role? What was the impact that the environment and the changes were causing on them? That's why I wanted to get involved, because I don't want only the scientists to tell them what was to be done, but also for their voices to be heard. And these are very knowledgeable people that had been living in those areas or regions for, in some cases, centuries when you're talking about indigenous peoples. So I came into IUCN and I thought it was a challenge, a tremendous challenge with all these scientists, extreme scientists, and people specialized in butterflies and one type of tree. And start looking at that dimension and trying to convince them that social issues were important. And believe me, it was a tremendous task within IUCN, because they were not acknowledging people. They couldn't see the relationship about how women and men use the forest in a different way, that their needs were different. It's interesting that at the community level, it's a lot easier than what it is at the institutional level. There is some kind of correlation between having a PhD in tomatoes and not understanding gender issues somewhere on the line. So the person who was running the Mesoamerican office at that time had been doing some field work and had been faced with the fact that his beautiful mangroves were getting destroyed because of the use that people were giving to it. So he said, if you can help me save my mangroves. And we started a very small social program, and it grew and it grew and it grew. And we were very much concentrated on gender issues. For example, in Mexico, there is an area in which the whales go to breed and to deliver their babies. And for many years, they had been bringing the boats out, disturbing the whales when they're delivering, and I mean, handling it in a very poor, poor way. So we decided that with a group of women, we're going to help them to train themselves as the first boat captains in the whole region so that they can go out and take the tourists to visit the whales and do it in a more sustainable way and take care of their resources. The funny thing was, we thought it was going to be rather easy. And it was not that the men were against it. Even the women to handle some of the most basic issues, like getting into a bathing suit and exposing their bodies. We weren't aware that that was going to be a constraint. And then we find out that they didn't know how to swim. And we had to taught them how to swim. They had been living all their life by the sea. But the myths and the taboos prevent women to go into the ocean. If a woman get into a boat, it will bring bad luck and it will not fish. So there are thousands of these myths that nobody even remember who created them. And it took us almost 4 months to overcome the whole issue of managing your body and learning how to swim before we can train them to be captains. And the first time they went out into the ocean, it was like if the whales knew what these women were out for. And they came so close to the boat. When they came back and they got $500 for 10 people that they have taken out in the boat, it's all the money that they have ever seen together. And they were talking to the whales from the beach saying, "You are going to save my kids. This is going to be my new source of income. And I have seen you all my life from the beach, and I never knew this is going to be. I'm look after your baby whales, and you're going to be looking after my kids." So this is how things make the difference. And these women now are very powerful. They go to schools. They talk to other women. And you have to see how the kids, their kids, look at these women. They're so proud of their mamas. They're so proud of what they're doing. So those are the win-win situations where you empower women to be able to utilize in a very sustainable way, but at the same time, they are the first in line to conserve those resources. Believe me, all the environmentalists are really happy when they see that, because their lions are going to be safe, because their turtles are going to be doing better.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. Today's program is a special collaboration with the Women Rising radio series, a project of Crown Safira Productions. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. You can also visit us on the web at radioproject.org. Rosamira Guillen can still recall her childhood explorations in the tropical forests near her home in Barranquilla in the northern region of Colombia. Those same forests and the animals and people living in them are now the focus of Rosamira's life work.
I did enjoy very much the wild experiences, the nature experiences that I had as a child with my family. Back then, I did not perceive that I would end up doing the same thing now, but I certainly enjoyed it. It's really inspirational. Every time I go into the forest, it's just filling up with energy, with passion, with just fills your soul. The green, the smell, the sounds, the whole feeling of it is just really, I get really emotional about it. I enjoy it very much.
After college, Rosamira was awarded a Fulbright scholarship in landscape architecture in the U.S. When she returned to Colombia and became the director of the Barranquilla Zoo, she found out about Proyecto Titi's campaign to protect the endangered cotton-top tamarin monkey, which lives in the very forest Rosamira loves so much.
Cotton-tops live 30 to 40 feet above the ground in the tropical forest of northwest Colombia, and they're very hard to see, and they're like the size of a squirrel. It's a 1-pound monkey, but they have a just gorgeous set of white hair in the head. And the little face is like a warrior, you know, they're kind of fighting for their life. And they are very important to the ecosystems where they live because they eat a lot of seeds and fruits. So they digest the seeds and they get peeled off and fall into the ground and germinate right away. So they help reforest while they move around the area where they live. They also eat insects, so they help control insects in the forest. And they are also food for other animals. So Proyecto Titi found a way to track him in the wild because they're hard to see. They don't like humans. They stay away because they know they get in trouble. But fortunately, in our field site, they have gotten habituated to our day-to-day visits of our field team. And so they get close enough that you can see them. And sometimes we give them bananas for, you know, just to be able to get close to them, either study them or just make sure they're doing okay or just get a close experience. The closest I have gotten to a cotton top is probably 1 foot or something, just a face-to-face thing. The forest where cotton tops live has been going down for cattle ranching and for agriculture, and is down to only 2% of the original coverage. It's like you're living in the bathroom of your house because somebody tore down your whole house and you're confined to live in this very small space. So our efforts are to be able to protect forest and to keep a population of cotton tops that can be expanded over the future in the long term and be able to save this species for future Colombians and for my region and for where I was born. We have been working for over 10 years in a fragment of forest that is within a cattle ranch farm. So we are working dedicated to finding the funds to be able to buy this forest. And once we buy this land, we will set up a reserve. So that's one major goal of our project TTT. And then the other one is the other threat of cotton tops, which is humans. What happens is that there's a lot of little small communities around the forested area, very impoverished, that need to feed their children, and they have many children. So they go into the forest either to hunt animals for the pet trade, cotton tops included, or parrots or howler monkeys. And they also cut trees to sell the wood or for firewood. So we have made a very strong project to work with the communities. And we were so lucky to find the formula that has worked very well. And it is the Ecomochila project, which is crocheting plastic bags, recycled plastic bags, the ones that we use in grocery stores, to build mochilas, which are like tote bags. So we do all the marketing efforts for the Ecomochilas, and especially in the U.S., they have been very well received and accepted. And they are now producing about 200 mochilas a month. In 4 years, we have recycled more than 1.5 million plastic bags into mochilas. We have produced about 8,000 mochilas. We're very happy and proud that we're able to get this going. And we are now giving full-time jobs to about 150 women in the area. So we were able to give them an alternative source of income so they would stay away from the forest. And one of the things that happened recently, which we think could be a good tool to get close to the government, which is a challenge that we have now, is the fact that with the census that we did for cotton tops in years 2006 and 2007, we were able to finally have a number, a real number, of cotton tops left in the wild. We presented this information to the International Union for Conservation of Nature, the IUCN. They set out the red lists of the different species in the world and their status of conservation. And we were able to upgrade, if you can call that an upgrade, for cotton tops from endangered to critically endangered. And that means that puts cotton tops one step away from extinction. So it's like an alarm that we have set on to say, listen, we need to do something about this, otherwise we'll just lose an endemic species. I have always felt I want to do something meaningful with my life. Cotton tops cannot speak for themselves, so I'm doing the talking.
Ecology, sustainable development, and green jobs never have to be feared as a trade-off with sound economic practices. The two go hand in hand all over the world. In the northern steppes of Uzbekistan, Elena Bykova is bringing ecology and the economy into harmony with her work to save the Saiga antelope.
Steppe, it's very huge space, grassland. Sometimes it can be rather desert region, but it's huge space. You can be very spiritual in this place. I feel myself in a step like in the beginning of the world, because nobody there, only you, ground and sky, nobody more. You can't be very spiritual in this place. It is a very good place for Saiga, because it's a big space and Saiga can run there. Saiga is antelope species. He looks really strange, but for me it's very pretty animals. Saiga live in huge herds, It can be 1,000 animals. Saiga live in harems. They have very few males and a lot of females. Only males have horns. It's one reason why they are more attractive subjects for the hunters, because saiga horns very valuable for the traditional Chinese medicine. It's very huge illegal business. It's why a number of saiga decreased very rapidly over the very short time. The main threat of the saiga is poaching by local people. It's why we concentrate all our efforts for working with local communities. It's why we develop our educational program and our program for development of sources of income. I'm rather new for the saiga conservation. I work for the saiga only 5 years. We begin from development of our educational program. And I'm very impressed by this program because we involve children from local schools, teachers, and their parents. We organized some competition in local school, and everybody happy take part in this competition. Our children draw, made embroidery about saiga, write very funny, very clever stories about saiga. Many children wrote very nice stories, but my favorite is one girl who is really talented. I was very surprised because she write not like child. It was about saiga who had some big ambition about their beauty. Saiga watch its reflection in the lake, like in a mirror, and thought, oh, of course I'm very pretty guy, but I would like to have big horns like deer, and I would like to have elegant long leg like gazelle. And he asked God, and he gave what he want, and saiga received very beautiful big horns and long legs. But exactly in this time, wolves come, and saiga began to escape from the wolf. But long leg and big horns was very terrible for the running. Our saiga, he stopped and said, oh God, please return me my short leg and my small horns. And it was done, and he escaped from the wolf and thought, thank you God, everything goes well with me.
Elena Bakova works to bring creative and sustainable income to the steppe by organizing profitable embroidery cooperatives for women and by initiating other projects to encourage poachers to stop hunting the male saiga antelope for its horns. Her efforts are bringing back the saiga herds.
We receive some trust in the local community through our activity with children, through our public awareness activity, and people already know us, and they begin step by step to trust us.
That's it for this Women's Desk edition of Making Contact. These profiles of international changemakers were co-produced with Lynn Feinerman's Women Rising radio series, a project of Crown Safira Productions. You can learn more about the work of these courageous women at radioproject.org. If you'd like to order a CD of this program, our toll-free number is 800-529-5736. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Additional audio courtesy of Animal Planet, Cynthia Siang, Mario Ulloa, the Plectro Trio, and Mandala. Stephanie Welch is production engineer, Lisa Rudman executive director, Peggy Law is our founding director, senior producer Tina Rubio, and I'm your host, Sandina Robbins.